Thanks for being part of the Surviving Grief podcast. A quick programming note, starting in June of 2024, Surviving Grief will be moving to bi-weekly episodes. That means a new episode every other Monday. Now, let's get to today's conversation. Welcome to the Surviving Grief podcast, hosted by our grief ministry leaders at Crossroads Church. We'll be sitting down with friends as they share their powerful stories of loss and healing, and we'll hear from grief professionals and other wise people with useful tools for our own time of grief. If you're supporting someone who's grieving, you'll learn how to comfort them and walk with them on their own path to healing. Let's join the conversation.
I'm Charity Hipp. I am 53 years old, just turned 53. I'm a widow. I was single for 45 years. I mean, till I reconnected with Mike, and that was kind of my journey. I had started out with the why question that we all, as a single, as we get older, why God, why am I still single? That desperation, and I heard a message here, Brian Wells, and he said, you know, that's a valid question, but there's another one word question: is what? What can God do? What can God do in you during this time that he can never do in another time? And so I stopped and I started asking that question, what God? And so really I inundated myself with like, Lord, what do you have for me? And it mostly was around this place, around Crossroads, serving, and just still wanting to be married. I babysat for a family just to get that, you know, I want a family, so I need to see how they operate. Kind of thing. I was doing everything. And it just never, you know, I think I served too much that, you know, I never met anybody, which was fine. I met Mike when I was 23 years old. He actually hired me. We worked together. We did sewer rehabilitation. He taught me how to operate a backhoe and helped me get my CDL license and all kinds of fun stuff.
Where young romance blooms.
It is in the sewers. It blooms in the sewers. Nobody knows that. If you want to find a man, go work in
There's
the sewers.
There's going to be a surge of single women hanging out in the sewers.
Yes. So he was a great teacher. He took me under his wing. I fell immediately for him. Unfortunately, he had a girlfriend. So there was nothing going to happen there. And I didn't stay long because this was early 90s. The company, even though Mike was all for it, the company was not all for women working in construction. So they kind of booted me out. So we went our separate ways. And in 2010, we reconnected on Facebook. And like everybody does. And just had dinner, reconnected and whatever. But there was nothing really going on. And so then 5 years later, I had just moved into an apartment and I started waking up and at like 3 a.m. thinking about Mike. And this happened for like 4 nights. The fifth night when I woke up, there was a wall lamp in my apartment that had never worked and it was on in the middle of the night. And I was just like, okay, I get the clue. I need to reach out. So I did. I texted Mike and was just like, hey, just been thinking about you. And he texted back and we met up for lunch. And the theme around, he had told me that he was lonely. He had, he was a recovering alcoholic. And so bar friends were all gone. He was fishing and working. He's like, that's all I do. And I said, well, you should come to Crossroads. You would meet a ton of people. And he's like, I would if somebody would invite me. I was like, oh, that's me. So I invited him. And that's where we started kind of hanging out and dating, just, you know, going to church together. And this was when they first started talking about the wolf pack and the five marks of a man. They introduced Man Camp. Before I knew it, Mike was like, oh, I got in. And I was like, you got into what? He's like, into Man Camp. And I was like, you've only been to Crossroads 3 times and you're going to Man Camp? He was all in. He was all in for that. And that changed him. That changed the course of our relationship. I truly believe we would have dated for years if he hadn't gone to Man Camp. And just about a month after he got back, he looked at me and he said, I've enjoyed the time we've been spending together, and I want to be the leader in your life that God's calling me to be. And I was like, what? I was like, that's like the phrase I've wanted to hear for the last 45 years. I was like, are you kidding me right now? Like word for word. So that just turned into this romance, and just, you know, we just fell in love with each other, and he continued. He went to Man Week and got baptized, and then we found a log cabin on 5 acres in New Richmond. We bought it, and we got married in November 2015, and it was amazing. It was just 2015 will always be the year, just the best year of my life. There's nothing can compare ever to it. Sorry. So we, you know, we're newly married. 2016 didn't start off too great. His brother died, which took a big toll on him. It was his younger brother. And then we had to put, that sounds awful. Like my father had to move into an independent living. He didn't enjoy that. So that was a struggle. And then come October, I had to have a hysterectomy. I was 45. I knew 45, 46. I knew my limits, but I was still hoping that God was going to do a Sarah miracle of like, yeah, you're going to give us a baby. But that didn't happen. I had to have a hysterectomy, and that was hard. And I did the wrong thing. I stuffed it. I just said, I'm not going to let this ruin my marriage. I have this wonderful man who needs kids. We're going to go off an adventure. We're going to have this great life. And so I just left that be. And then in 2017, in April of 2017, he was diagnosed. He went in for a colonoscopy. They could not even get a pediatric scope in. He had a massive clot, or whatever you call it, in his colon. And they took that out. But he was diagnosed terminal from the get-go. The first, our first appointment with the oncologist, he was just like, there's nothing I can do for you. The best thing you can do is join a research study and help society. And I was like, okay. And that's all we ever heard from doctors. It's just like, we're here just to prolong your life as long as we can. So we started chemo in July. Mike was a rock star with chemo. I mean, he had it every other week, and he was still fishing. He was a semi-pro bass fisherman. He would still do fishing competitions. He did man camps. He still was up there on the weekends chopping down trees. I mean, the oncologist was like, you're living a better life than me. Like, what's going on? Like, couldn't his blood pressure... I guess chemo is supposed to make your blood pressure rise. His blood pressure was always really low. I mean, never affected him. He just was a rock star. I mean, he'd have his days where he'd feel sick. But so I truly believed that, you know, we're going to do this for the next 10 years. And that's okay. You know, we'll just, that's our new normal. And, you know, the statistic is 2 years with treatment. And Mike was, it was a statistic in 2019, he died. And that, I think, was the biggest shock for me, was that it happened so quickly. But we had an incredible adventure those 2 years. God blessed us more beyond measure. And the biggest one was that, you know, I said every Monday night he would go up to man camp and meet with these guys, and they said they were working. They were blowing up stuff, and they
the
would
air quotes. For yes, those of you who can't
yes,
see
they
it,
were
the air quotes were
working. Yeah. Yeah, they were blowing up stuff and talking and being dudes and being guys. And one Monday, he didn't feel well, and he's like, "I'm not going." And at 9 o'clock at night, I had 9 guys at my door, and they're like, "Mike, come out and talk." And they were out on our front porch till midnight. And I just sat in there and just cried and just like, thank you, God. I mean, that's all Mike wanted was real friendships. That was the first thing he said to me, is I just want friendships. And God just boom. And there they were. These were men, and these weren't just like friends, buddies. These were men who would die for him, who would come at 9 o'clock at night. They all had families, and they came and they sat with him till midnight and just would pray with him and talk with him. And so it's just beautiful. It was just a beautiful thing that I got to witness. I look at Mike's life. I look at how I came at where my role was, and I just see how I feel so blessed that I got to be a part of this, even though, you know, it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. But man, God did a good work in there.
So Charity, during that time, as he was starting to decline, what was that like for you, kind of knowing there is going to be an end to this? You don't know when it's going to be,
right?
But did you feel like you were already kind of preemptively starting to grieve?
Oh, yes. Mike wasn't big on emotions, so there was no crying. And so every day when I drive to work, that's when I would do my crying. And that's when I would do my, Lord, I don't know what I'm, you know, I need you. And I definitely started to grieve. I actually would envision the whole funeral and all that. And I really believe that was God's way of preparing me, of like, this is going to happen. We did go and see someone, you know, the Farron camps for a ministry time. And I'll never forget, because Brad stopped in the middle of his prayer and he said, I've never seen Jesus more clearly. And I knew then, I knew that the fact that he saw Jesus so clearly was that Mike was going with him. He wasn't going to stay with me. And that was before he started to decline. But I just knew that. So, yes, I was preparing. I was grieving. It was more of, I don't know about, I didn't know what grieving was, actually, then. So I don't know. I just know I upped my caregiving. Like, I threw Mike a surprise birthday party on July 2nd. He died August 19th. We had a surprise birthday party for him, and it felt really weird. But I just, like we always say, we always wait till the funeral to everybody get together and tell this person how we feel, you know. Why not do it now? Mm-hmm. And it was really hard because he had lost a ton of weight. There were people from his childhood who came. He got to see all these friends. So those times were really good. We then, the last weekend in July, we had planned this trip before he started to decline. We were going to go out west. That was our favorite. We were going to go to a rodeo in Wyoming, and then we were going to go to the Tetons. And, you know, I was like, are you sure? We don't have to do this. Money's no big deal. We can cancel the trip. He's like, no, we're going. So the end of July, we get on a plane and fly out to Cody, Wyoming. And we had one really good night at the rodeo. We just had a really good time. I'll never forget, though, I always did selfies wherever we went, just to, even before he got sick, we just like want to mark the moment. And I wanted to do a selfie at the rodeo. And he's like, no. He's like, I hate the way I look. And I was like, honey, I'm not going to post this on Facebook. Now, this is just for me. And it just killed me that he never wanted to look like a sick person. And yet he did at the end. So we went, and by the end of the trip, I mean, this man had so much pride and grit. You know, he couldn't tie his shoes by the end of the trip. He was so weak. But yet when we got to Utah, Salt Lake City airport, I had a transport ready for him, a wheelchair. And he just looked at me like, no way. And I was like, we don't have to take it. And we walked by and I said, thank you, we're good. And it wasn't until we got to Cincinnati. I said, and it was 11 o'clock at night. I said, can we just, and he's like, yeah. And I had to wheel him out of the airport in a wheelchair, and that about killed me because my husband was very strong, and it was just super hard. The whole trip was really hard. We got back and we saw the oncologist, and he said his numbers were so high that chemo was no longer a valid option. And so he said, and he told us, you know, we asked the question, and he said, you have about 2 months as far as he could see. And so the other thing that just really always got me is we stood out in that parking lot at OHC, and he said to me, he looked at me, he goes, I love our life, and I love you so much, and I love our life. He goes, but I just wish I could go back home to live with his mom for a little while. I just want to go back home when times were simpler. And I said, I know. And it was just hard. But yet Monday morning, he's getting up and he's like, I'm going to work. I got to finish paperwork and stuff. And I'm like, okay. I know. I was just like,
that paperwork doesn't stop.
Yeah. He's like, make sure, I got to make sure everything's taken care of. And I was just like, okay. And I said, I'm going with you. My work was so great. They gave me a laptop and they said, you just don't come back until you're ready to come back. And so I went, and he was still astonished. I said, I'll drive you, because it was 45 minutes for him to work. And he's like, you will? He was like, you're really going to do that? And I was like, well, yeah, of course I am. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm just, mm-hmm. We're going to go. We'll go to work. And he lasted about, 2 hours, and he was ready to come home. I finally convinced him that we should call hospice, because he was in just so much pain. And he just didn't want to do, he just didn't want to do anything about it. And we called hospice, and a nurse came in to evaluate him. And when we were doing paperwork, I was rambling. And I said, the doctor said 2 months. And she's like, he said that? And I said, it's not going to be 2 months, is it? And she's like, from what I see, it's about a week. And I was like, okay.
And was that in front of Mike or
no,
just to you?
No, that was just we went downstairs to, he. That was the one day that when I said hospice is coming this morning, he did not get out of bed. He stayed in bed. It's almost like he's just like, fine, I'm going to give up. Not give up, but because for so long, he's just like, I'm not going to die. We're going to fight this. We're going to fight it. And so we went downstairs, and that's when she told me that. And I was like, okay.
So Charity, I mean, that, when you say that's okay, that's a huge abbreviation in timeline from what,
right.
The timeline you were operating from. So as she's delivering that news to you and you have your husband upstairs, yeah. who's in the bed and in a way that he hadn't been prior to this, tell me what's happening for you in those minutes after she shares that updated timeline with you.
I'm just this way. I was just like, okay, we're going to do what we got to do. I'm going to see this. I wasn't emotional. I wasn't, I called some friends to have them come up and be with Mike, some men that he knew, to come and talk to him and just comfort him and help me then get him in a car to take him to hospice. I don't know. I'm like, that's the way I've always been. It's like, I'm still in caregiver mode. And I was still in caregiver mode until like the second day at hospice, when I went to the nurse and I said, Mike hasn't eaten and he hasn't anything to drink. And she just looked at me and I was like, that's not why we're here. And she's like, no. And I finally was just like, okay, I can let down my guard a little. But I still was, he wanted, when he was in hospice, he was rambling around and trying to get out of bed, and they hadn't put a catheter or anything in. So he wanted to go to the bathroom, and the nurse came in and she was like, we'll do a bedpan. And I was like, you don't get it. My husband's a cowboy. He's not going to pee sitting down. Like, he is going to see this through. And I got him up. I said, come on. He could hear me. He couldn't respond really, but I got him up and he like fell into me, and I just sat there for a minute. That's when I broke down, because I was like, this is the last time I'm going to get to hug my husband. And we shuffled him off to the bathroom and he went, and he's just that guy. And I loved him for it. I loved him for the strength and the grit that he had. And it was hard. But we had a lot of friends come saying their goodbyes and just comforting me, which was great. Huge community just came in, and hospice was like, you have a lot of friends. I was like, yeah, I have a really good community. And that last day before he died, I was sitting there with him. I had some music on and just sitting there. And, you know, you get that thought that I always say it's God's voice, but it's not audible. It's just a thought. And it's the thought that I heard. He's just like, I'm not done with you, Charity. He's like, I still have plans for you. And I almost felt guilty for even hearing that because I was like, he's still alive. And then the nurse had told me that it was probably going to be that night. And just from things that I've read, and I knew that I told him, I went ahead and told Mike, I said, you can go. I know they're calling you. I know. Just go. I said, I'm going to be okay. And you need to just go. And he did. It, you know, the journey, I almost, and this sounds really bad to even say out loud, but the journey was like, at some point he was so sick, he would just throw up in the middle of the driveway. And I wasn't used to clean. I'm not a mom. And I wasn't used to cleaning up, throw up. And just his eating habits were so radical because he would be hungry for one thing and I'd scurry off to get it or make it. And then he wouldn't be hungry. And just that back and forth. And I'm like, Lord, you have to do something. We can't live like this. You either need to heal him or take him because we can't do this. Mike was frustrated. I was frustrated. I mean, we were newly married. We were only married 4 years when he died, you know, so marriage is hard just as it is, getting used to each other. And then you add all of this on, and it was incredibly hard.
And Charity, I really appreciate your willingness to share that, because I think when people are in caregiver mode, yeah, that's a hard thing to voice, and it's a real thing that caregivers experience, right?
Yes.
It's this combination of loving that person,
right,
who's sick and wanting to show up however you can, but you're human.
Right.
Right? You're like,
yeah,
how do you manage your own fatigue levels and your own frustration levels? You know, that's not,
right,
something that's talked about all that often is the frustration. What does that look like,
yes,
for you? So, you know, as you're in hospice and Mike passes, for you, was there a sigh of relief that he's not in pain, that it's just, you know, tell me what that process is,
yeah,
looking like for you.
It was a relief. It was, I mean, I didn't want him to go, but it was just like, I could finally sit down and not, my brain finally stopped for a minute just to not have to think of like, where do I need to be? What do I need to do? I'll never forget my first trip to Kroger's after Mike died. Was just like, I can buy anything I want. Like, this is nuts. Like, I didn't have to think about, you know, what's going to pass through the colon and what's going to be, you know, I could just, and I actually had my first meltdown though in Kroger's because I was like, I don't know what to do now because I have no, you know, for 2 years there was this purpose of going to Kroger's. And so it was a good thing yet a bad thing. It was like, I'm relieved, but yet now I don't know what to do. The kicker of the whole thing is, so I had my father was slowly declining with dementia and he was still alive. So God and I had some words because I was like, how is this fair? How is it that my father, who's 86 years old, I'm still caring for him. Like the day after, because he had dementia. He had no idea that Mike was sick, that Mike died, nothing. And so he calls me and's like, well, I need my laundry done or I need that. And I'm just like, really? Like, how is this fair? I hate that word, but I'm like, how is this even happening? So caregiver mode was not completely over for me. And I did not do it gracefully after that because I was really mad.
Well, and you touched on this kind of earlier where as you received challenging news,
mm-hmm,
you did what a lot of caregivers do. It's, okay,
yep,
what do I need to do?
What do I need to
What's
do?
The list? What's,
yes,
the priority?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that transition period of not only now caring for your father, but you have this weight of grief over you.
Yeah.
What did that acknowledgement process look like? Did it take time? I mean, because you went right into taking care of your dad.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's hard to turn off that checklist and priority. And like you said, for 2 years, you had a purpose.
Right.
Purpose is we're gonna fight this.
Right.
How do I help him? How do I alleviate this? So what did that look like?
It just was, I went numb for a while. And I still was in caregiver mode because I was planning this funeral that I didn't want to go to. And I felt that this funeral was for everybody else but me. And so it was my job to plan. I even asked Dawn, who was helping me plan it. And I was like, can I just like come in after the music starts and sit in the back? And she's like, no. But I was just like, I don't even want to be here. I don't even want to do this. And I realized that I had to do it for everybody else. So everybody else could see that I was okay and for them to have their time. And it was super hard for me. I put on my big smile and I greeted everybody with a hi, thanks so much for coming. And it was, I look back now, it's super awkward for people because they were just like, okay, you know, normally the widow is crying and I'm just like, thanks for coming. So good to see you. You know, I was good at stuffing. I was good at just putting it away and knowing my priorities and knowing when, you know, and then I went home and then I cried and I cried and cried a lot. But I knew then too that I had to do something. I didn't want to be 10 years later ending up at midnight in the parking lot of Sharon Woods screaming at the top of my lungs. So I'm like, I have to do something now. I have to figure this out because this is just too hard. So, you know, still taking care of Dad, but kind of putting that on the, I did very little for him. And I, you know, felt bad, but there's only so much you can do. And then I stayed away from community just because it was hard to just navigate. And I just wanted to, you know, cry. I wanted to talk about Mike. I wanted to cry. Nobody wanted me to do any one of those things. There were very few people that were safe for me to just be able to do those things with. I mean, my poor friend Michelle, I called once and I said, I'm going to tell you something. It's going to make you extremely uncomfortable, but I have to say it. I was like, I just want my husband back. And I started crying. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but I just have to say it. So I think that's what makes the grief during that time super hard. Because when you're a caregiver, I'm an Enneagram 2. I'm a pastoral, you know, all those things, mm-hmm. you know, taking care of everybody else is just always first priority and kind of putting myself on the back burner until I could.
I love that you have such great self-awareness
yeah.
on who you are, on your operating system,
yes.
because that's, a lot of people, that's a tough concept to wrap their head around.
Yeah.
And so the fact that you are skilled in knowing your personality strengths on
yes.
that, it actually helps you understand a little bit hindsight what your grieving style is also.
Right.
Mike had a large community of men.
Mm-hmm.
What did that look like when you think of the people who were most helpful and the people who were safe? You know,
yeah.
you mentioned Dawn
yeah.
as well. The people who were willing to meet you in that relational trench of grief,
yeah.
because it's scary, right? Grief has a funny way with people who either are inexperienced with grief or it brings up their own grieving styles and
right.
they just don't know how to engage. Do I ask? Do
yeah.
I not ask? What's
right.
happening here? Yeah. So, you know, specifically with those relationships of his community, who was the most helpful, you know, in terms
yeah.
of like actions or just sitting with you? What did that look
yeah.
like?
Well, when he was in hospice, I had a group of guys over there just doing the yard work, cutting wood because I had a wood burning furnace system for the house. And they were just, they have to do something. And that's what they were doing. Dave Scheller would just come pop over and mow the lawn, I never had to call him, never had to ask. He was like, what can, you know, he would just come over and find stuff to do. Right up the street from us was Emmett Ridge Farm. The Boswells were, that was my safe place. Like, I remember after Mike died, just like not wanting to be alone. I just drove up there, sat in the parking lot, and just started, was just crying. And Jeremy came out and was just, he just let me cry. And they would bring me into the house and just let me sit there. And they'd go about their family dinner and just let me be, not be alone. And they would listen. They were amazing. That was my safe place. I knew I could go there and just be. 'Cause being alone was hard. So the community of people, I mean, I had, it was amazing. But yet, you know, in the beginning, it's all the texts and all the phone calls, and you're just trying to manage it all was super hard too. But they were, everybody, the men that Mike, in his community, I mean, they came over and did all the lights in my basement, redid them all because it was, they weren't up to code. They just found stuff. They just, I mean, we lived out in the woods, so we'd never locked the door. And so they would just come over and just while I was gone and just do things that they knew that the house needed or whatever. Dave Stansberry, I mean, it just came out and did so many projects. And to me, that was just, I don't know. It felt like Jesus. Like, you could just rest knowing, like, I didn't have to ask. For me to ask people for help was hard. And so they just knew those things, and they just knew, they didn't, nobody asked. They just came in and did stuff.
You know, there, for those of you listening that are supporting someone in grief, or in that, you know, you know a caregiver mm-hmm. who's in that anticipatory grief role, gosh, everything that you're describing, Charity, I think is just so poignant, because after hospice and after the funeral, and when those texts start kind of flooding in, the typical question is, what do you need? Right. Just let me know. Let me know what you need. And when you think of a caregiver who typically does everything, they're not going to ask you. They don't even know what they need, right? Yeah. And so the fact that there were tangible actions that were anticipating your needs, anticipating mm-hmm. the gap, I mean, that's just such a blessing.
It was huge blessing.
Like you said, to be able to just rest.
Right. I was able to just kind of sit back and know that I didn't have to think about what needs to be done. They just, things were being done.
Now, Charity, let's go back to that prompting you had, that this was not the end of your story.
Yeah.
This was, in a lot of ways, the start of your story.
Yeah.
So tell me, what does like life look like as you progress kind of through this initial early stages of grief, right, and where that journey took you?
Yeah. The other, for my grief journey, that was a little, and I'm not the only one, but for me, it was a little weird, was COVID. Like, so the next year was COVID. And so any kind of thing that, you know, people talked about their worlds blowing up, I'm like, mine already blew up. It didn't, you know, that kind of thing didn't affect me, but it also made it more isolating, which wasn't bad. It was kind of good, because I was just like, I don't have to perform. I don't have to, you know, but it was hard. That was, COVID made it hard. I went through a grief recovery. It's called the grief recovery method. It was, for me, it was 12 weeks, and I went through that whole thing. And so I decided to become one of their certified recovery, they call them specialists. I don't know how specialist I am, but they call them specialists. So I did a certification for that and started helping people, other widows. And it would be all over Zoom because of COVID, but I met with different women, and that actually was very therapeutic for me, just to listen to them talk about their story and be able to relate and be like, I think that's one of the biggest things is with grief, is you feel so out of control, and you feel like you're, something's wrong. Like, there's literally something wrong with me, because I can't control my crying. I can't control my emotion. This is weird. And to be able to tell someone else and to see it in other people and be like, no, this is normal. You know, this is the normal reaction to loss. That's just huge, I think. Sitting down with these other women taught me a lot about what was normal. So that became my new norm of working from home, doing this, doing the grief recovery, I still just didn't find a lot of peace at home because the weight of the house and the 5 acres and all of that was sitting on me. And I kept on hearing the Lord's just like, don't you want to rest? And I was like, I can't rest. I've got to make sure. Mike had a lot of stuff too. He had a lot of toys. I love him, but he had a lot of toys to, you know, get rid of, to sell, to do, find some home for them. And so that consumed my time a lot. So there was a lot of the keep busy. It was a lot of the just keeping busy. And it wasn't until 2022, after my father passed away, that I finally just made, I was stuck. I just like, I have to do something. And I decided to move to Texas. I sold the house and everything in it, packed up what I could in the 4Runner and drove to Texas. I had a friend who has a nonprofit, and she's like, if you'll do my accounting, I'll give you an apartment. And I was like, perfect. And so I went to Texas, and it gave me a lot of space and a lot of time to grieve. And I did a lot of crying there. But still didn't rest. You know, I was still on the go. Let's go explore Texas. Texas is a big state. I spent a whole year doing a lot of things that Mike would have loved. One of the things I did horseback riding lessons, and it was at night. And I'll never forget just crying my eyes out when we took the horses out to the pasture for the evening. And I just, Mike would have been so, he would have loved every minute of it. So just remembering him through those things and thinking about him. And then shortly after I got there, I decided that there was something that I've always wanted to do, was to just travel. And so I planned a trip in June of 2023. I packed the car up again, and I drove from Texas to Montana. And it's so funny because I have my journal in front of me, and this journal is filled. I went back and read it the last couple of days, and like the specific instructions that God was like, this is what it's like, the wilderness. And this is what you do in the wilderness. You reconnect, you feed your spirit and not your flesh, and you all these things. And I just felt like the Lord was taking me on this journey of like, you need rest and you need peace. And I finally said, yes, I do. And when I first got to Montana, I was surprised because I thought, this is going to be so easy and so fun. I'm going to go hike and do all the fun things. And I sat and cried for a good 2 weeks and just slept. And actually, literally just slept. My body was done. I was finished. And yeah, the Out West was the 4 months. I call it my 4 month silent retreat, because the only person I had to talk to was God. And that's what really, you know, like healed me. And I know that sounds, that's not anything. My community helped me heal. Every piece that I went through helped me heal, because I know that's not normal. You can't tell somebody, well, you should just pack up everything you own and go out West and you'll be healed. But for me, and so I carried along still that loneliness from when I was single for all those years. And so there was still that healing to go through too, that grieving. And the other thing was, you know, I mentioned earlier that I had a hysterectomy and I stuffed all that down. Well, I turned 50 years old and that came popping right back up. So stuffing grief is not a good idea, because I sat on my front porch and I was like, now I have no husband and I have no children and I'm really all alone. And so really Texas and Out West was grieving that. That's a big one that I don't think anybody talks about, grieving the fact of I'm not going to be a mother. And then I'm going to die alone. You know, I know I'm not, but those thoughts. And I feel that that's what going out West was for. It was healing that wound and reconciling the fact that, yes, I'm alone and it's okay. That was a huge one. It's just like coming and actually being able to say out loud, yes, I am alone. I'm going to eat the majority of my meals for a while now alone. That's a fact. But and I have to reconcile that and be okay with it. And that's what being out there did for me.
Charity, you know what I really appreciate about you talking about the differences and what each person's grief journey looks like, yeah, is that God meets us in that, right? He meets us in the messy, and that's what you needed to heal. You, yeah, needed that time separated, that silent retreat, yeah, if you will, to, yeah, let some of that stuff bubble up. And that's what's just so crazy about grief, is that things come to the surface that we didn't even know were going to be a problem, right? Like, we didn't, right, even know that was on the roster, right, of things that we might need to take a look at, journal through, you know?
Yes.
And so it's kind of the great equalizer, mm-hmm, for how are we doing?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, when it felt like it was at its most overwhelming, when you're in Montana and you're asleep, you know, you're physically fatigued, you're, mm-hmm, sleeping all the time, and you're kind of wrestling with some really hard things from the past, hard things from the now, and what life looks like moving forward. So when you felt like you were at your hardest points there by yourself in Montana, how did God meet you in those moments?
I would say he met me most with giving me that rest. He met me most. I have journals. Like, that's the way I hear from him. And I just start journaling and I go back, and he just said a lot of truths to me. He just said, he was just like, grieving. He's like, grieving is an emotion I gave you. He's just like, this crying and this feeling sad is okay with me. And it's okay for you to do this. This is part of fully knowing who I am. It's not something. And the biggest thing I think he taught me was, we went back to the garden, and he's just like, I just don't want you to hide from me. He's like, you know, that was the initial, and I just don't want you to hide from me. I want you to let me into that deepest place of you. What is the deepest? And I know, rationally, I know God knows, he already knows it, but letting him in and saying those things and writing those things down, this is the deepest hurt in me, and not hiding it. And there was just a peace out there that just, I don't know, it's hard to explain. And you know, he gave me a lot of words. He gave me a lot of scripture. The Exodus 14:14 was what I lived by. It was like, the Lord will fight, God will fight for you. You only need to be still, and just practicing that. It's like, I just need to sit here, and you're going to, you know, talk to me, giving him that space to actually talk. And actually, I am like sitting and listening.
And what an incredible operating manual for a caregiver,
yeah,
who is go, go, go. We're not still. Yeah. That's right. Not what we do.
No.
And so for you really forcing that place of stillness, yes, in order to receive healing, mm-hmm, what a powerful gift that is.
Yes. Yes. It was awkward. It felt like I should be doing something, but I'm like, I have nothing to do. It's crazy to go, and you go, just, this is the example, I go to get my oil change, and they're like, we're sorry, we're going to, you know, it's going to take an hour longer. I'm like, I got nowhere to be, you know, and that just doesn't happen in everyday life. And so to just be able to be like, I can just sit here for as long as you want me to, because I have nothing to do and nowhere to be. Yeah. And just, it feels awkward. It feels, at times you feel like I have no purpose. I struggled with that when I got home. It's like, what purpose do I have? I have no one to care for. Like, my dad is gone. My husband's gone. I have nothing to care for. I got rid of my house that was, to maintain. What do I do with this? And that's what we've been working on now. It's like, that my purpose doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be doing something. But I'm still a tough cookie to break. So I'm still like, what can I do? Where can I serve? You know? And that's just, for me, that's the hardest part of just knowing that I'm just his. And I don't have to do anything. I can just be. So.
Well, in Charity, so you didn't stay in Montana, though, because you're here now.
Yes.
So something,
yeah,
happened between Montana and you being back here.
Well, no, that was always the plan. The plan was never to just stay out there. It was to definitely just be out there for the summer and then come home. And it from the get-go, it was all part of his, you know, the plan of just go do this, come home, and then get grounded and build a life. And, you know, I thought that when I came back and I'm all, you know, I did this twice now, I'm all healed, I'm good. And then I go get an apartment, my first apartment, and well, my only apartment. I got my apartment, and the first night I stayed there, I cried my eyes out because I was like, I'm starting to get rooted and you're not here. Mike, you're not here. And then I bought my house, and the day we closed on the house, that morning, I just cried all morning. And my poor realtor's like, are you having second thoughts? And I'm like, no, I was just like, it's just hard. I'm like moving on. I'm moving forward without him. And it's just, I realized then and there, it's like everything in my life is going to be bittersweet. It's just going to be because he's not, I'm going to be moving forward without him. And there's no getting around it. There's just no. So it's the lesson I think that I learned, that I'm still learning, is that, you know, grief just becomes a part of me. It's just a part of me now. And that's okay. It doesn't mean that it's, I think I have more empathy towards other people because of it. But grief is just going to be a part of it. There's always going to be something, not in everything, but in a lot of things, it's just going to be bittersweet. And that's okay. I do believe that God created all these emotions, and we get to fully be in who God created us to be when we feel all of those emotions. You know, so much we try, me specifically, try to stay in a comfort zone. I just want to be comfortable. I want to be comfortable with what I'm doing, my temperature of my house. Everything has to be this comfort. And it's like, but going out of that comfort zone and feeling the hurt, it's a horrible hurt. I wouldn't wish it on it. Like you said in your intro of the podcast, it's like the club that nobody wants to be a part of. It's that ache that nobody wants to feel. But you got to feel it. You just have to feel it. It's otherwise, I don't know where you go if you don't, you know?
So for Charity, for the people who are listening to this, who are in that current active caregiver role, they have a spouse that's ailing. They know they're on the clock. They know that there's a timeline. And right now it's just a full to-do list of just trying to fight and to stay busy. And sometimes God can get lost in all of that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Because you know that you have this terminal, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there's a healing, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And thank you, Jesus. But there's lots of people that's not the case.
Right.
And so how would you encourage those people from a faith standpoint where it just feels like you don't have room for anything else? You just, it's lists, and there's some fear and there's some anxiety and, you know, sleepless nights in there too. In the midst, you know, I love that you describe kind of the throw up on the driveway, and you're like, there are just real things that are difficult, tangible things, not just the weight of a spouse being sick, but just day-to-day things that are really, really hard. So how would you encourage that person that they're not sure where their faith stands in the midst of all of this?
I described a lot of my grief journey as I knew God was there, but I couldn't get to him. And I guess I would encourage that person to just know that God is there. He doesn't expect anything from you. He just doesn't. He knows he's right. He's right there with you in this. And there's really nothing to just let go. Because I think you put then more responsibility on yourself of like, I've got to take care of me, plus do all this stuff. And I've got to make sure I'm connected to God. And he's just like, just be, just listen for my voice, just be, and give yourself a ton of grace, that you're not going to do it perfect. Nobody does. It's not something you signed up for. It's not something, you know, even just with the emotional stuff, it's not something you know how to handle. And giving yourself a ton of grace and just, I don't know, what all I could think of was I just wanted Mike to know he was loved and feel that he felt loved every day that he had cancer. And that was my sole purpose. And that's where what came out of it was the meals and the other things. I just want him to know he was loved. It's hard. It's a hard, and everybody's journey is different. And just to know that you're not alone, like it's perfectly normal that you're having thoughts of, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. This is horrible. Like, what are you, and yelling at God, telling him, I'm done. Like after Mike died, somebody had mentioned something about a 5-year plan. And I was like, oh no, there's no more plans. I waited 45 years to get married planning, and the plan is over. And I even told God, I don't trust you anymore with a plan. So I'm not doing one. And God's okay with that. You know, he knows that. So getting angry with God, and just to not hide, to just pour out that deepest, darkest, you know, feeling inside of you of like having those. I was always told, and I truly believe, it's the cry that kicks things off. It gets things going. Throughout the Bible, it's the cry. It's the, I can't take this anymore. And when we do that, then God's like, okay, now I'm coming in.
Absolutely. The levees break.
Yes. Right? Yes. And to not be afraid, and to be okay with just crying out and saying, I cannot do this anymore. You have to help me because I can't do it. I'm at a loss.
Charity, time away from the initial loss of Mike, kind of now looking back to where you are now. And I love that you talked about there's still things, right? There's still things that bubble up, and grief is innately a part of us as we move forward in life. And while God doesn't cause the loss, he redeems elements of the pain. So what does some of that redemption look like? You touched a little bit on working with other widows and kind of finding some solace there.
Yeah.
What does that look like for you today?
He just has redeemed. I talked of the empathy. I just having more empathy towards just people in general. I feel more for people who are hurting. And I guess I would say working with mostly widows, but working with anyone who has loss has just been one of those things he has redeemed. I think Mike's story was just something that showed me how intimate God is. Like the way I tell it is like God knew Mike was going to die. God can see forever, and you know, he knew Mike was going to die, and he's like, he has to be with me. He has to be with me. And so he introduced this whole community and just swooped him up, and all Mike had to do was say yes. God put all of these things in front of Mike, all the invitations to man camp, to get baptized, to just serve and to be vulnerable or whatever. God put all of these invitations in front of him, and Mike said yes. And to me, that's super encouraging to like live my life that way of like, I just want to say yes to whatever God has for me, because it's just going to produce this fruit. I don't know. I feel like I know God way more than I did or ever would have if I hadn't have gone through this journey. And so he's redeemed. I don't know if it's a redemption. It's definitely a redemption, but it's just a building of my faith of just like, God, you're good. You are just good. And my days are not my own. My life is not my own. You know, it has to be all for him. And I can't step back and ask why. I mean, it's, again, we talked about that. It's a valid question, and it's, you know, God's okay with that too, but it's, he's just good. He just has worked all of this out for good. I think it moved a lot of people's lives, a lot of men's lives, watching, you know, seeing him struggle, but yet fight. And I know he got to, you know, just talk to a lot of guys, recovering alcoholic, and he, one man camp guy, you know, they're all drinking. Mike was always okay with it, never bothered him, but guy came up and said, I think alcohol is hurting my marriage. Like, how did you do this? How do you sit here and not drink with all these guys? I mean, he just, God used every ounce of Mike's illness and our journey to just, I don't know, to do a whole lot of good stuff. That's a
Charity, you do such a beautiful job of honoring not only Mike's legacy, but also the struggle that you both went through, the struggle that, I mean, because you fought to get to the other side of your grief journey. Yeah. You fought to find healing. Went to Montana.
Yeah.
You went far.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, the question that we always ask people is that now a little time removed, mm-hmm. what does good grief look like for you?
Yeah. I think good grief looks like knowing that it's there, and allowing it to be part of my life. We live in this broken world. It's all part of it. But it can bring us all closer to one another. And so good grief is being real, not hiding from God, not hiding from each other, and actually starting to talk about it, saying, you know, this is how I'm feeling. And what you sometimes have to do for people is say, I'm about to tell you something super uncomfortable, but I have to say it. Getting them off the hook, because we all innately want to help somebody. We all want to give a good word to make them feel better, to stop crying, to whatever. And instead giving people off the hook, like, you don't have to say anything. I don't need, there's no words. There are no words that you're going to do to help me, but I just need to talk about it. And inevitably, then they can talk about their deepest hurts. And I think when we stop hiding it all, that's good grief. Good grief is just having a community where we don't sit around and boo-hoo and feel sad for each other or ourselves, but we can talk about it. And we can laugh all in the same time. I mean, we talk, my friends now, my friends who are widows, we talk and we're just like, you know, we have a good cry. One minute we're crying. The next minute we're like, yeah, if we date again, they're going to have a medical test before anything happens because I'm not going through that again. You know, and we can laugh about it too. But having that full range of emotion is, I think that's really good grief, is when you can just talk about it. Like, it's just part of your life. Like, I went to college and graduated and got married. You know, you talk about the events in your life and you can talk about your grief. It's like, my husband died and it was a hard struggle, but, you know, he is now having a ball. He's fishing and having a great time. I am been given a really good life, a really blessed life. And I look forward to whatever comes along next.
Amen.
Yeah.
Well, Charity, we so appreciate you sharing your story. Thanks. And this is another episode of Surviving Grief.
Surviving Grief is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. If you'd like to connect or share your own story, reach out to us at podcasts@crossroads.net. That's podcasts with an S at crossroads.net. We'll see you next time.